This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Tom Clancy, Firing Point by Mike Madden. Read for you by Scott Brick. In valor, there is hope. Tacitus. Prologue, Pohang, South Korea. Alive, not dead. That was the order. Jack got it. Rick Van Delden, if that was his real name, was the only link between the Iron Syndicate and the nameless Merc outfit the Syndicate hired for their dirtiest hits. The Merc outfit was their real target. Find Van Delden, find the outfit. Simple as that. But Van Delden had been hard as hell to find. Impossible, actually. Until a lead, finally, that led them here tonight. Their one and maybe only chance to grab him. Alive, not dead, meant keeping the big Dutchman alive so they could find and eliminate his murderous organization. The only problem with that was Van Delden was one of his outfit's heavy hitters. The 6'6" killer possessed serious combative and tactical skills. The giant Dutchman had put more men in the ground than a gravedigger's shovel. Don't even think about taking this monkey on by yourself. Get eyes on him. Call for backup. Sit tight till the rest of us show up. Savvy, Clark said in their brief before the campus team split up. All hands were on deck for this op. John Clark, Ding Chavez, Dom Caruso, Adara Sherman, Midas Jankowski, and Jack Jr. They all headed in different directions across the steel mill's huge complex of buildings. Too much ground to cover for them to buddy up. They had to go it alone to find the guy. And fast. Van Delden was in one of a dozen possible places on 200 acres of property, and scheduled to leave within the hour, according to their source. They couldn't risk missing him here tonight. If he shook loose, he'd be back in the wind the minute he left, and they'd lose the only shot they'd ever had at rolling up his crew. Alive, not dead, was tonight's mission. But it seemed like a pretty good idea for him and the rest of the team, too, Jack thought, as he made his way through the cavernous shell of the integrated steel mill. The cold night fog looming over the port outside stopped at the doorway, the air inside tinged with the acrid smells of rust, ozone, and burnt coal. Jack Ryan Jr. was a big, blue-eyed white guy striding confidently through the dark, hangar-sized structure. He didn't look that out of place beneath his stolen white safety helmet, clipboard, and paper mask. He moved fast, like he had something to do, which he did. The steelworkers were too busy flying several hundred tons of molten slag in giant ladles lumbering overhead to pay attention to him. Jack sweated beneath his shirt. It was an industrial volcano inside the sweltering building. At least the team had Sonitus Molar mics. Without bone conduction for a reception, he wouldn't be able to hear the others calling out their sit reps on his comms. The infernal din of pounding hydraulic hammers, roaring diesel motors, grinding steel, and blaring alarms was a near sensory overload. I'm 30 seconds from target, Tom whispered on his way to the plant manager's office. Copy that, Clark said. Jack took two steps at a time up the yellow steel staircase to the pulpit, the automated control room for the hot steel processing facility high off the floor. The grated treads led to the landing just outside the control room door. With his back against the corrugated steel wall, he did a quick check around him. Helmeted workers below were focused on the job, not him. From the landing, a steel grating walkway ran parallel along the windowless steel wall of the pulpit where Jack stood. On either end of the east-west walkway was a catwalk. Both catwalks ran north, parallel with the tracks of the huge ladles moving slowly along beneath them. Each ladle brimmed with nearly 200 tons of molten steel heading toward the vacuum degassers on the far side of the building. In the middle of the steel control room door stood a small, face-size observation window. I'm in position, Jack whispered. Copy, Clark said as a siren wailed overhead. Jack stepped over to the door's observation window. He scanned the room. In front of the big-picture windows overlooking the mill floor, five young South Korean technicians sat at their monitors chatting excitedly, pointing at virtual gauges on their screens. Scanning right, Jack saw Park, the oldest Korean in the room, standing in the corner, round and silver-haired beneath his safety helmet. Jack recognized Park from his file photo. He was the steel firm's CEO and biggest shareholder, and a man in serious trouble with Japan's largest Yakuza syndicate, the Yamaguchi Gumi. Their source inside the syndicate said Park was reaching out to Van Delden for protection tonight. Jack leaned over to see who Park was talking with, and there he was. The giant Dutchman towered over the diminutive Korean, his long granite face focused on Park in earnest discussion. The Dutchman's gaze shifted briefly toward the window, his eyes locked with Jack's. Shit! In the blink of an eye, Van Delden's big Glock 17 was in his hand. Jack ducked as the barrel sparked. The door glass shattered just above his head. Found him, Jack barked in his comms as he crouched low and pressed hard against the heavy steel door. He felt more rounds thud against the metal, like someone was pounding the door with their fists. Sit tight, Clark said. We're on our way. 5 mics max. Copy that. More bullets crashed into the door near Jack's ear. Don't hurt him, Jack. Copy that. Whoomp! The big man slammed into the door. The steel cracked against Jack's skull and knocked him back a little. But Jack was wedged hard against it. The door only budged open an inch. He slammed it back shut with his shoulder. Jack heard the last shards of the shattered window glass breaking above him. He glanced up just in time to see the black steel slide of the big Glock wedge through it, then angle down, thick fingers wrapped around the hilt. The Glock fired 3 ear-splitting shots that chinged the grated steel floor near Jack's feet before Jack could react. Jack turned and grabbed the hot slide with his left hand and twisted it upward, just as Van Delden fired another shot into the steel rafters overhead. The hot barrel burned Jack's hand as he squeezed, but he caused the last shot to fail because the slide couldn't fully eject the brass. With his left hand still gripped around the Glock, Jack pulled his SIG P229 Legion Compact SAO with his right hand and smashed the steel butt against the Dutchman's thick wrist, breaking it with a sickening crack. The massive paw dropped the Glock and yanked back through the shattered glass. Jack kicked the Dutchman's gun over the edge. Status? Clark asked. Still got eyes on? He ain't going nowhere. Whomp! Van Delden crashed against the door again before Jack could brace himself. The steel door blew open, tossing Jack backward, dropping him to the grated landing. Jack raised his weapon to put a bullet in the Dutchman's knee, but the man's giant steel-toed boot kicked the gun out of Jack's hand and sent the SIG sailing over the edge, clattering onto the cement floor far below. Jack's hand exploded in pain, as if it had been smashed with a sledgehammer. His momentary focus on his aching hand cost him dearly, as the same big boot raised high and smashed down into Jack's gut, knocking the wind out of him. Jack gasped for air and clutched at his belly as the boot raised up a third time, aimed squarely at his skull. Jack rolled away at the last second, the sole of the massive boot clanging against the steel near his ear. Jack rolled again just as the Dutchman launched a kick at his skull and missed. Van Delden lunged forward for a final, fatal steel-toed shot to Jack's temple, not seeing Jack's 3-inch Kershaw spring-assisted blade until it plunged into his inner thigh. Van Delden screamed and grabbed his leg to staunch the blood. He stumbled away past Jack before the campus operative could strike him again, limping west along the walkway as Jack struggled to stand. Jack, we're close. Stay put, Clark ordered. Jack shook the pain out of his hand as he grabbed a couple of deep breaths, his stomach aching like he'd been gut shot. Jack, you copy? Jack glanced up just in time to see Van Delden turn the corner north, heading away from the pulpit. Copy, was all Jack said. He sure as hell wasn't staying put. He had his orders, alive, not dead. But Jack knew there was a long, nasty road of hurt between the two, and he was happy to take the big man along for the ride. Jack thundered along the steel grate, racing after the giant operator. Even wounded, the big man was fast as a feral cat. Jack turned the corner, running past the giant ladle of molten steel crawling along on its track 10 feet below him. Even from here, the searing heat made his skin tingle, like standing too close to a campfire on a cold night. Van Delden! Halt! Jack shouted over the noise of the giant ladle motors grinding overhead. Van Delden limped farther along, leaning heavily on the rail, one bloody massive hand gripping his thigh. He finally stopped as Jack charged up behind him. Turn around, asshole, Jack said, finally able to pull his backup gun, a striker-fired SIG P365 SAS Micro Compact 9mm. The thick shoulders turned. On the dimly lit platform, the Dutchman's rugged features glowed in the seething light of the lava-like steel approaching them. The backs of Jack's legs itched with the heat through his trousers. Jack pointed his pistol at the big man's chest. The Dutchman grinned.
"Afraid to pull the trigger, little man? Oh, hell no. But I've got my orders. Tough guy, huh?"
The grin disappeared as he winced in pain, his trouser leg soaked in blood. He raised himself up to his full height, 5 inches taller than Jack. His broad chest was like an oak barrel, and his tree trunk arms bulged beneath his shirt sleeves. Jack's finger tightened on the trigger.
"I won't kill you, but if you make a move, you're going to be pissing through a straw for the rest of your life."
The Dutchman's eyes searched Jack up and down, calculating speed and distance to target.
"Clark, you copy?"
"I copy.
You have the Tango in sight?"
"I'm sitting on him. Hurry the hell up."
"Almost there. You good?"
The air roared with the noise of the automated crane hauling the giant ladle just below them. Jack caught the glow of the white-hot steel in the corner of his eye.
"I'm good, but Van Asshat is in a world of hurt."
"Who sent you?" Van Delden asked.
"Nobody you'd know."
"What do you want with me?"
"You're the link to an outfit we're interested in."
"Interested how?" "You are police?"
"Not exactly."
"Do you know who I work for?"
"Your outfit contracted for the Iron Syndicate."
"The Syndicate is dead."
"I know. We're the ones that rolled them up. It's your organization we're going to take apart next, thanks to you."
"Ha! You really don't know anything about us, do you?"
"No. But I promise you, within the hour you'll tell me."
Van Delden gritted his teeth, grimacing with a strange "fuck you" smile at Jack.
"Something strike you as funny?" Jack asked.
The big Dutchman suddenly frowned, confused. He punched himself in the jaw. 1, 2, 3 times. Jack heard his teeth crack even above the noise.
"What the hell is wrong with you?"
Van Delden's desperate eyes darted around, searching for some kind of a weapon or another way out. The Dutchman's bloodied fingers tightened around the steel railing. Jack suddenly realized that the much larger man could use the railing as leverage to throw his bulk at him, even on that bad leg. If one of those meaty fists clocked his jaw, he'd be lights out. Jack stepped back.
"Don't move."
Van Delden inched closer.
"Afraid, little man?"
Jack shook his head.
"No one's pointing a gun at my nutsack."
The Dutchman smiled again, a sliver of sunlight in a storm cloud. But then it faded.
"What are you willing to die for, little man?"
"What kind of a stupid—" In a single vaulting leap, Van Delden threw himself over the railing. Jack lunged at the man to grab him, but he was too late. The big Dutchman plunged feet first into the glowing ladle 10 feet below. His massive frame barely rippled the blistering surface, the white-hot liquid swallowing his last sharp cry. Jack stood at the railing staring at the bucket of molten steel inching relentlessly forward as Clark, Dom, and Adara came racing up behind him.
"Where the hell's Van Delden?" Clark asked, leaning over the railing. "I told you we needed him alive!"
"I know," Jack said, holstering his pistol. "But he had different plans."
October 18th. Chapter 1. Aboard the container ship Jade Star. Second Officer Luis Loyola stood outside on the starboard bridge wing, vaping a sweet menthol jewel pod. He admired the blanket of stars shimmering across the black velvet sky. His seaman's eye suddenly caught the breaking wake of what was probably a dolphin's fin racing toward the hull far down below, then watched it dip beneath the blue-black water, night feeding. He smiled. Amazing animals. And always a good luck charm. The ship's bow surged toward a waxing moon blazing like a searchlight, illuminating the dark Pacific waters in every direction, all the way to the horizon, or so it seemed. Out here in the South Pacific, he couldn't see the lights of any nearby ships of any size. His radar had indicated the nearest fishing vessel was some 140 kilometers away. He might as well have been on the surface of Mars for the solitude he craved tonight. The ship was sailing on a smooth sea at 15 knots, a little more than half its rated speed, to save expensive bunker fuel. The 102,000-ton deadweight vessel was powered by a 93,000-horsepower two-stroke diesel engine, thrumming far below decks. It was burning 90 tons of fuel a day at current speed as it drove the ship's 30-foot diameter copper alloy, six-bladed propeller. He cast a quick glance at the deck, stacked with red, blue, and green shipping containers. In fact, the Jade Star was fully loaded with 8,465 20- and 40-foot shipping containers, including South Korean industrial pipe and fittings, washing machines, refrigerators, car parts, rubber tires, X-ray machines, and, strangely, 700 liters of human blood. The ship was also illegally carrying 300 tons of ethylene and other combustible chemicals, used in a variety of manufacturing applications. The legal restrictions for recommended storage and transportation precautions were ridiculous and prohibitively expensive relative to the cost of the chemicals themselves. He wasn't worried about their safety. As the ship's administrative officer, he was duty-bound to be aware of such things. But if stopped and searched, he alone would be the person charged with the crime. But all of that was of little concern at the moment. He was off the clock now, and couldn't give a damn about what they were hauling. His only concern was that his son's birthday was yesterday, and as far as he knew, his puta ex-wife hadn't bothered to give the boy the quadcopter drone he had sent him last week. Loyola loved his life at sea, but he loved his 6-year-old son even more. He was torn. It was the sea that had cost him his marriage, or so his wife said, blaming her whoring with every swinging dick in Lima on him not being around to satisfy her womanly desires. Hija de puta. He took a long drag on his jewel, then watched the breeze sweep the vapor cloud away into the darkness. If he didn't quit the sea, he might lose his son altogether. Besides, he hadn't had a pay raise in 3 years, let alone a promotion, and neither was on the horizon. He had thought about quitting many times, but as shitty as the non-union wages were, they were still better than anything else he could manage from a desk job back home in Peru. At least this way he could save up money for his son's future, even if he missed his son growing up. He felt a dark despair falling back over him again, and thought about the bottle of golden blue Korean whiskey he had stowed away in his cabin. His drinking had gotten worse this trip, and it was probably time to back off. His last fitness report by that maricón captain had warned him about his drinking, but that asshole didn't understand the pain he was feeling. Loyola took another deep breath of salt air and forced his mind to forget his troubles. For all of the pain of being a sailor, there was nothing like standing out on the bridge on a night like this. He'd sailed around the world a dozen times and seen things on land and at sea that no civilian would ever see. Not bad for a street kid who used to hustle cigarettes and lottery tickets in the filthy Lima slums. Loyola took another long, thoughtful pull. Yes, perhaps he would try to find some kind of job at the port, nearer the boy. Maybe even teach him how to play football, as his father had taught him. And with the money he'd already saved up, perhaps a house out in the country, with a boy. A thundering blast deep beneath the vessel threw Loyola to the deck, slamming his skull against the steel bulkhead. Stunned, Loyola crawled to his knees as the breaking hull tore apart with a scream of shattering metal. He was tossed against the rails of the bridge wing, cracking his ribs, but his desperate hands wrapped around the nearest post to keep from falling several stories into the ocean. The air filled with a wail of alarms and klaxons. He tried to blink away the blood pouring into his eyes from the wound in his broken scalp. He watched in horror as the bow and 600 feet of ship behind it broke away and plunged headlong into the sea. The rear section where he lay surged ahead, still under power, and crashed into the upended hull in front. Steel containers spilled out of their holds and into the water, and a dozen screaming crewmen along with them. Secondary explosions ignited the incendiary chemicals, enveloping the shuddering wreckage in unquenchable fire. Within minutes, the entire ship and its cargo were lost, sent plunging into the depths of the warm Pacific. There were no survivors. October 24th. Chapter 2. Barcelona, Spain.
Jack stood at the bar of Lavi, his favorite restaurant in Barcelona. It was located in the El Born district of the old city, called the Ciutat Vella in Catalan, the language of Catalonia, the semi-autonomous region of Spain. It was also a local's favorite, which was saying something, because Catalanes really knew how to eat and drink, and did so quite often late into the night. Jack took another sip of sweet red Spanish vermouth. Van Delden's suicide was a distant memory, thanks to his time in Spain. It had been a week since Jack woke up in a cold sweat in the middle of the night reliving it. Now numbed to the horror of the Dutchman's excruciating death, Jack still couldn't help but wonder what kind of organization inspired that kind of fearsome loyalty. Jack had loved his time in Madrid, but he was utterly captivated by Barcelona. He could see himself living in this city, despite recent events. Spontaneous mass protests of hundreds of thousands of people had shut Barcelona down several times in the days before he arrived, but lately all was quiet. Jack sensed there was still something in the air. Most protesters favored Catalonian independence from Madrid, but not all. Independence wasn't the only issue. The rage that had driven freedom-loving people into the streets was the recent sentencing of Catalonian independence politicians to long prison terms by Madrid. Spain still lived under the long shadow of Franco's fascist dictatorship. Though Spain was now a democratic republic, heavily armed riot police battling barricades of unarmed Catalonian civilians elicited hard memories from the earlier times. It was an emotional response, not a rational one, Jack thought. But modern politics was only about emotions in the Western world these days, including here. The protests changed nothing. Madrid still held all the cards because it held the monopoly of force. Barcelona was a city on the edge of another eruption, which made it all the more interesting as a place to be. At 6-1, Jack's broad-shouldered frame towered over most of the locals who crowded the place at lunchtime, which, throughout Spain, lasted until at least 3 o'clock. The energy level in here was somewhere between a late-night disco and a rock concert. Jack could hardly hear himself think above the din of excited diners jabbering away in a half-dozen languages, particularly Catalan, its own unique mix of Spanish, Italian, and French. Catalan was one of the many things that made Catalonia separate and distinct, which was why Franco had outlawed the language during his regime. Jack had little more of the language than si us plau or gracias in his vocabulary, but even using those few words was enough to elicit a smile from appreciative locals, particularly those favoring independence from Madrid. If all else failed, Jack knew the words for the tapas he loved best, especially bombas and pom tomacat. In a worst-case scenario, a finger jabbed onto a menu item along with a smile would always do the trick. Today was Jack's last day in Spain. Despite the highly social atmosphere, he was by himself. The life he lived as a covert operative wasn't amenable to long-term relationships. At least, not for him. He'd seen the pretty blonde at the other end of the bar when he first came in and saw her check him out. She wore no wedding ring and appeared to be by herself. She had a Bluetooth stuck in her ear and engaged in a very occasional conversation with someone on the other end of the call. Between shots of bubbly cava and bites of crispy croquetas de jamón, she tossed subtle sidelong glances at him in the mirror that stood behind the counter. Even if she was interested in him, he was already packed for his American Airlines flight back home tomorrow. He only traveled with a laptop and a buffalo leather satchel crammed with a few days' worth of clothes. He preferred washing his things to throwing them out and buying new ones, unlike a famous fictional character he admired. The only thing he needed to remember to grab in the morning was his dog-eared copy of George Orwell's Homage to Catalonia, which was the reason for his stop in Barcelona. He'd first read the book in college, and its last prophetic pages had haunted him for years. When Jerry Hendley told him to take a few weeks off after his last mission with the campus in South Korea, he decided to revisit the idea of Spain, and in particular, the Spanish Civil War. He loved being an off-the-books operator for the campus, the black side operations of the financial firm Hendley Associates, carrying out missions for the American government that otherwise couldn't be handled through normal channels. But lately, Jack had been considering the words of an old Jesuit professor he'd bumped into in London a few years back. His subconscious was nibbling on the edges of an idea to go back to school and get his doctorate in history, just like his dad. Maybe. Nothing on this trip persuaded him to quit the campus. The work was too important and too damned exciting. But he also had to admit he had been utterly captivated by his time in Spain and experiencing it through a historian's eyes, rather than through the green glow of night vision optics while chasing tangos. It was one thing to read about a great historical city like Barcelona, but something else altogether to stand inside a 900-year-old church with the bones of Crusader knights entombed beneath the stones at your feet. He plopped the last of the glistening pimientos de padrón into his mouth. The small green peppers fried in olive oil and dusted with sea salt practically melted on his tongue. He seriously considered ordering another vermouth, but decided to just finish the one he had and pay the bill. The clock was ticking, and he had a timed entrance ticket to the Picasso Museum, which was just up the narrow medieval street of Carrer de Montcada. It was the last item on his list before leaving tomorrow. He raised a finger to the passing server who set his check on the bar in front of him. Jack counted out the bills he needed to cover the tab along with a generous tip. He noticed he still had a few euros left in his wallet and decided to toss those into the tray as well. He didn't need euros in Virginia, and the young server was working her ass off. God bless her. Adeo, Barcelona. Chapter 3. His bill paid, Jack polished off the last swallow of his drink when he happened to catch a glimpse of a striking young African-American woman as she edged her way into the restaurant, clearly looking for someone. Renee Moore? Jack couldn't believe it was her, after all these years. They'd had a few senior finance classes together at Georgetown, and, as often happened when two smart, attractive people spent a lot of time together, fell into an intense but brief relationship. Renee Moore was the most career-minded woman he'd ever met, and that was saying something coming from a household of highly accomplished Ryan women. But her mind was set on conquering Wall Street. She was perfectly gentle, but crystal clear when she broke up with him. She wasn't looking to get married. Ever. Jack hadn't seen Renee since they'd both graduated 7 years ago. He had often wondered if she could have been the one who got away, because she had so many of the qualities he most admired in women. But then again, her top priority was earning a Wall Street fortune. His wasn't. Jack believed in living for things worth dying for, and money wasn't one of them. He'd actually thought of reaching out to her a couple of years ago for a Costa Rican banking project he was tackling as a white-side analyst at Hendley Associates. Moore had a first-rate mind and an incredible work ethic. She would have been perfect for the gig. He'd even thought he might be able to convince her that things like duty, honor, and country were just as significant as making $1 billion by the time she was 30. But every time he thought about picking up the phone, he didn't. Most people's loyalties were only to their own ambitions. That didn't necessarily make them bad people. But if his dad taught Jack anything, it was that the only life worth living was a life of service to others. And like the man said, you can't serve two masters. Above the din of happy diners, Jack shouted her name. She began searching the crowd until she spotted him, which wasn't hard, given his height. A luminous smile lit her up for a moment. Then it turned to confusion as she made her way over to him, squeezing her 5'6" frame next to him at the crowded bar. She reached up and gave him a hug. Renee, I can't believe it. What brings you to Barcelona, to this place? Smile lines creased around Jack's blue eyes. For a second there, I thought maybe it was you, but... He could barely hear her above the noise. He raised his voice. Can I get you something to drink? The tapas here are unbelievable. No, thanks. She glanced around the room, clearly searching for someone, occasionally standing up on her tiptoes. Can't find who you're looking for. She turned back to Jack. Sorry, I'm being rude. How have you been? You look great. Put on a few pounds of muscle since I last saw you. Yeah, hitting the weight room every now and then, Jack said. She touched his face, a familiar gesture. The beard's new. I like it. Tell that to my mom. He wanted to tell her how gorgeous she looked, too. Better than he remembered. But he knew that wasn't going to go anywhere, and he wasn't looking to seduce her. He was just genuinely glad to see her. The pretty girl with the Bluetooth at the end of the bar seemed happy to see her, too. She kept glancing back and forth between her second cava and Moore. What are you up to these days? Moore kept scanning the room and checking the door. Henley Associates, a small private equity firm in Alexandria. You? I'm a VP with a tech startup in California called Crowdscope. Tech? I thought you'd be in finance.
I am, just the other side of it. It's a fintech firm.
Sounds exciting. What happened to Wall Street?
Been there, done that.
Jack's Apple Watch beeped. Oh man, I gotta run.
Hot date?
No, just the museum. I've got a timed entry. Any chance we could grab a drink later, or maybe dinner?
She turned back around and smiled at him.
Yeah, Jack, I'd really like that. She reached into her purse and pulled out her business card.
Call me around 7. We'll find a place to meet, okay?
Perfect. He glanced at the address and phone number, then pocketed it.
How long are you in town for?
Jack shrugged.
Leaving tomorrow.
Too bad.
Her smile faded.
I've missed you, Jack.
I'm so glad we bumped into each other. What a crazy coincidence.
Jack ignored the screeching voice of the catechism nun in his head telling him that there was no such thing as coincidences.
Try the vermouth here. And the tortilla. It's fantastic.
Hell, everything is.
Well, gotta run. I'll call you later.
Make sure you do.
She threw another hug around his neck and kissed his bearded cheek. Adeo,
adeo. Jack gently pushed his way through the crowd of people, heading for the exit. He cast another glance at Moore at the bar, still searching for someone, and the Bluetooth blonde, still watching her. As he stepped through the doorway, a short, heavy-set man about his age, with shoulder-length hair and thick Warby Parker tortoiseshell glasses, bumped into him.
Sorry, man, he said to Jack as he passed.
No hay problema, Slick, Jack muttered, thinking nothing of it. Finally breaking through to the narrow street, Jack checked his watch. His online ticket would get him into the museum in 5 minutes, which was perfect timing. A glance in the window of a small jewelry store across the narrow street gave Jack the nearest shot for quick surveillance detection. The only person who caught Jack's eye in the glass was a guy about his size and age, with short-cropped blonde hair, a long crooked nose, square face, and deep-set hazel eyes. He also had a Bluetooth in his ear. It was a lot of data to acquire in a short glance, but that was how Jack had been trained by John Clark, the campus's director of operations. Like Jack, the man was catching a glimpse of him as well in the same glass, or so it seemed. They held each other's gaze for less than the blink of an eye before the man turned casually away and headed south in the opposite direction. He was just another tourist on the phone, Jack supposed. But his mind registered the man's strong athletic gait as he turned a corner onto Passage del Born. Jack turned north and headed for the museum. 3 steps later, he was dead. Or so he thought. The concussive force from the blast inside Lavi had nowhere to go but out the front door and into the narrow street between the heavy stone walls in a rushing tidal wave of pressure. Shop windows shattered for 12 yards in each direction. The sound of the explosion was like a shotgun blast in Jack's unprotected ears. The pressure from the detonation behind Jack was heavy enough to knock him forward, slamming his head into a wall, but he managed to stay on his feet. He turned, dazed, and staggered back toward the direction of the explosion. Broken bodies lay in the narrow street in front. He didn't stop to help them. They were dead. Blood and shredded flesh spattered the wrecked doorway as he picked his way through the debris and into the restaurant. The ringing in his ears muted the anguished cries and moans of the few survivors. Jack's limited emergency medical training under the watchful eye of Adara Sherman kicked in. But without a medical kit, there wouldn't be much he could do. He stepped around the wounded and the dead, pushing past overturned chairs and tables, desperately searching for more. His eyes finally fell on her crumpled form. One arm twisted unnaturally against the hinge of her elbow, her blouse torn away by the blast. Jack fell down at her side, broken plates and glasses crunching beneath his weight.
Her swollen face oozed blood from her nose, mouth, and ears. He laid a hand on her neck to check for a pulse, certain she was dead. But her bloodshot eyes suddenly startled awake. Jack nearly shouted for joy that she was still alive. Her swollen lips began to whisper. "Babe, it's me, Jack. Lie still. An ambulance will be here soon." Moore's dimming eyes pleaded with Jack. She tugged on his shirt sleeve with the bloody fingers of her one unbroken hand. He leaned in close, his ear next to her mouth. He saw her eyes fluttering, and the whites suddenly showing. But with her last ragged breath, she managed to whisper a single word. "Samler."
Chapter 4. South Pacific. On board the Russian Federation Navy submarine Glasov. Captain First Rank Nikolai Grinko read the notice a third time and swore. It wasn't a complicated instruction. Far from it. The extremely low-frequency transmission, ELF, from the ZEVS transmitter, pronounced Zeus, near Murmansk, was only capable of sending out minimal communications. The ELF data rate was so low that submarine comms were limited to receiving messages only from Murmansk, and those were little more than bell ringer notices. The microscopic data rate had always seemed ironic to Grinko. The Zeus transmitter was the most powerful in Europe. It required up to 14 megawatts of electricity fired through two 60-kilometer-long antennas in order to generate an 82-hertz signal with a massive wavelength of 3,686 kilometers. Only China's ELF transmitter, five times the size of New York City, was larger and more powerful. The low data transmission rate was the trade-off for the Zeus capacity to send a signal through several hundred feet of polar ice or ocean water, almost anywhere on the planet. The Glasov was currently submerged at 137 meters below the surface of the Pacific, deep enough to avoid any surface sonar detection from air or ships. A submarine like his only survived by remaining undetected. ELF was designed to help him remain so. Unless, of course, the bell ringer message was telling him to surface and receive new instructions from a high-density satellite communication, which it was. Grinko swore again.
"No mistake."
"No, sir."
Grinko searched the man's eyes for any sign of doubt. There was none. He wasn't surprised. The senior enlisted man standing in front of him was utterly reliable, as were the rest of his crew. The information systems technician, Grinko still called them radio men, didn't write the new orders. He only delivered them.
"Thank you. Dismissed."
The man quietly closed Grinko's cabin door. Grinko couldn't believe it. What was the point of changing position? The first test of the latest version VA-111 Shkval 3, Squall supercavitating torpedo, had gone perfectly, and equally important, undetected by the opposition. It had taken all of his crew's best efforts to avoid them to arrive on station. Propelled by a solid-fuel rocket motor and a terminal guidance system, the new Squall 3 had achieved underwater speeds approaching 300 miles per hour and struck its target with a range in excess of 12 miles. Keeping the weapon secret meant the Americans couldn't develop defenses against it. Why risk being found now by moving? For what purpose? Grinko rubbed his clean-shaven face, resigned to his fate. Submarine captains in the Pacific Fleet carried out orders from Vladivostok HQ, not the other way around. So be it. He picked up his phone and called his XO, issuing the order to redeploy to the new coordinates. Grinko's resignation turned to confidence. He was captain of one of his nation's most advanced submarines, carrying some of its most potent weapons. Vladivostok was handing him another opportunity to demonstrate to the arrogant Americans that their dominance at sea was at an end.
Chapter 5. Barcelona, Spain.
Who the hell was Samler? Samler was the last thing she ever said, and last words mattered the most, Jack told himself as he gently closed Moore's eyes. His hand hovered over her breathless mouth. He touched her lips. A last goodbye. Still wet with her blood and his skull pounding with a near-migraine headache, Jack glanced over at a middle-aged woman lying against the bar, whimpering in Spanish. Her eyes were shut against the blood oozing onto her face from a scalp wound and the stabbing pain of her injured left hand. Sirens screamed in the distance. Jack dashed over to her side. He snatched up a handful of paper napkins from the floor and pressed them hard against her scalp wound. He took her one good hand and switched it for his.
Sumano, empujar aquí, he said. No, not empujar. Sorry, I don't know the word. Just press hard.
But the woman understood Jack's middle school Spanish well enough. She pressed her good hand hard against the makeshift bandage as Jack took her other hand and inspected it briefly, before pulling out a large shard of glass from her palm. It bled too, but not as badly as the scalp. Jack pulled another stack of napkins from a dispenser lying next to him, compressed it into her palm, and folded her hand into a fist. "Hold this tight, okay?" Jack said, as he turned around to see who else he could help. His clothes even bloodier now than they were a moment ago. On the floor just a few feet away, he saw Moore's purse. A few cautious pedestrians crept into the wreckage of the restaurant, faces white with terror but eager to help. Ambulance sirens screamed just beyond the door. As tires screeched to a halt outside, Jack reached down and picked up Moore's purse, its contents scattered on the floor. He dug through the nearly empty purse looking for her smartphone, thinking that whoever this Samler was, maybe he'd called her earlier, or she had his contact information stored on her phone. Spanish EMTs charged through the doors with medical gear in hand, followed by four local police, their uniforms marked Guardia Urbana. One of the cops, bearded and burly, saw Jack standing in the middle of the carnage, rifling through Moore's purse like a looter, and began shouting at him in Catalá. Still dazed by the blast and numbed with grief, and with his ears ringing and a headache crushing his skull, Jack couldn't make out a single word of what the cop was saying, but it wasn't hard for him to figure out the guy was pissed. More sirens blared outside, and more tires screeched to a halt as even more police and EMTs arrived, charging through the broken doors. Jack pointed at Moore's corpse. "She's my friend. I'm just looking for..." But the big cop pulled his baton and charged at Jack, his eyes raging. Jack dropped the purse, but something in him snapped. His friend was dead, and he'd nearly been killed. And now this asshole is calling me a thief. Jack squared up to take the guy down as the cop raised his baton.
"Pare!"
"Stop," a woman's voice called from behind. The big bearded cop froze in mid-swing. He and Jack turned around to see a woman about his age in jeans and a leather jacket flashing a badge. Her shoulder-length hair was neat but not fashionable, and her small frame was trim like an athlete's. Despite his headache, Jack saw the pistol in a shoulder rig beneath her coat. She barked another order at the cop towering over her. He argued with her, pointing his baton at Jack. She turned toward Jack.
"He says you're a looter. Is that true?"
"No. I was looking for the phone of my friend..." Jack's voice trailed off, his legs wobbly. He pointed at Moore's corpse. Unexpectedly, tears welled in his eyes. The woman with the badge softened, but only slightly. She took Jack by the elbow. "Let's go outside and get you checked out." Jack sat on the stone stairs of the back entrance to the big Gothic church, Santa Maria del Mar. He was just 100 yards from the restaurant, facing a placeta, a small plaza. A uniformed EMT examined Jack's eyes with a penlight under the watchful gaze of the woman with the badge. A police helicopter's rotors hammered low overhead. Hundreds of spectators had gathered in the area but had been pushed back behind yellow police tape and barricades. A local TV journalist stood among them, interviewing people claiming to be witnesses to the tragedy. The plaza was filled with several ambulances and police vehicles, forming a staging area for medical treatment and a preliminary investigation of the blast. Jack saw police cars and vans marked from several departments. Mossos de Escadra, Guardia Civil, Policía Nacional, blue lights still flashing on most of them. The EMT gave Jack one last cautious glance as he pocketed his penlight. "No headache?"
"No.
I'm fine," Jack said, lying. The EMT's eyes narrowed with disbelief.
"Estás seguro? You are sure?"
He scratched his thin beard tinged with gray.
"Yeah, really. Thanks." "I think it is best you go to hospital. Get x-rays at least."
"No, I'm good.
You know,
It cost you no money for medicine here.
It's not that. I just don't want to go. I'm fine.
Then it is necessary for you to see a doctor when you get back to the States, vale?
I will, I promise. The EMT looked over at the woman and shrugged his reluctant approval, then dashed off with his medical kit to another victim.
My name is Laia Brosa. I work for the Centro Nacional de Inteligencia, CNI for short. That's our version of the FBI and CIA, how you say, rolled into one. Who are you?
Still seated on the steps, Jack stuck out his hand. She took it.
My name is Jack Ryan. Mucho gusto.
Nice to meet you.
Igualmente.
Brosa pulled out her smartphone.
Do you mind if I record our conversation? It's easier than taking notes.
Not at all.
And you said your friend Rene Moore was killed inside. Jack lowered his head and nodded. Yes.
She patted his shoulder.
I'm very sorry for your loss.
Jack raised his head.
Yeah, me too.
She was an American as well.
Yes.
And how is it you survived the blast, Mr. Ryan?
I was outside. I had just left to go to the Picasso Museum. If I'd waited another 30 seconds, I'd probably be dead too. You are very lucky. And what brings you to Spain?
I'm sorry, but I don't know why you're asking me all of these questions.
Because it is my job.
Your job is to find out who killed my friend and all of those other people.
We already know.
It was a terror group called Brigada Catalan. They claimed responsibility just a few minutes ago on the internet while you were getting checked out.
I read about them in the news. They haven't done anything like this before. Just a lot of talk, right?
Brosa shrugged.
Every terrorist who kills talks a lot before they start killing, yes?
Yeah, I guess so.
Jack glanced up at the flags hanging from several of the private terraces around the square. Most had patriotic gold flags with four red stripes, the official flag of Catalonia. But a few had the addition of a Cuban white star on a blue triangle, the flag of the independence movement. In the last few days, Jack had hardly seen any Spanish national flags here in Barcelona. In Madrid, just the opposite.
But these Brigada Catalan people, they haven't been violent, not like this.
It's a political movement, not a terrorist one, if I'm not mistaken, Jack said.
Until today, Brosa said, surveying the flags.
She muttered something in Catalan to herself. She turned back to Jack.
You are well read on Catalonian politics for an American.
Quite unusual.
We're not all idiots, Jack said, instantly regretting the comment. Most Americans weren't idiots. They just didn't pay attention to other countries because their own country was so huge and had plenty of its own problems. And not every American double-majored in history and finance at an elite university like Georgetown.
I apologize if I offended you, Brosa said.
Not at all. I'm sorry for my bad manners. Almost getting killed has put me in a lousy mood. The only reason I'm up to speed on Brigada Catalan is because I happened to read an article about them in El País yesterday. In English. So, yeah, maybe I'm just another American idiot, too.
Somehow, I doubt that.
So tell me, what brought you to Spain?
Miss Moore?
She was your woman.
No, nothing like that. Just friends. We hadn't seen each other in years. It was a pure coincidence that she walked into the restaurant.
My father says there is no such thing as coincidence, Brosa said.
Jack smiled, despite the headache.
Something funny, Mr. Ryan?
Not really.
And the reason you are in Spain?
The real reason he was in Spain was for R&R from missions he'd run for the campus in Poland and Indonesia in the past several months, and to clear his mind from the death of his friend Liliana and Van Delden's suicide. But Brosa wasn't cleared to be read in on any of that.
I studied a little history in college and read Orwell's Homage to Catalonia.
Do you know it?
Of course.
We didn't cover the Spanish Civil War in depth in class. I wanted to fill in the gaps by seeing it for myself. Brosa eyed Jack up and down, trying to decide if he was bullshitting her or not.
And did you find what you were looking for, Mr. Ryan? I came to find out more about the war, but I wound up falling in love with Spain. It's a fantastic country. Where have you been in Spain?
Chasing a couple of arms-smuggling shitbirds in Seville with the campus last time I was here, Jack reminded himself. It's been a short trip, unfortunately. Just Madrid, and then here.
You must come back then and see the rest. Galicia, Andalusia, the Basque region. Spain is not just one country, but a collection of many smaller ones.
Already on my bucket list, believe me.
So, Mr. Ryan, please call me Jack. Vale, Jack. Can you tell me what you last saw or heard before the explosion? Any protesters outside? Anyone suspicious?
The place was packed for lunch. Everyone seemed to be having a good time. I'd say half locals, half tourists, maybe. I heard German, French, Norwegian, but mostly Catalan.
You are very observant.
Just a curious tourist.
La Vie is very popular, one of the best in the city. I eat there often myself. No shouts of Visca Catalunya before the blast, or anything else that would indicate a motive for the attack.
No, nothing like that. People were just eating and drinking and having a good time when I left. Then suddenly... Well, you know the rest.
And your friend? What does she do? Why was she in Barcelona?
She pronounced the word Barcelona like an American, the C sounding like an S, unlike the Castilian Spanish of Madrid, which turned the C into a lispy TH sound. Barcelona.
I really don't know. Business, maybe. I'm pretty sure she was there to meet somebody.
Jack reached into his shirt pocket and handed her Moore's business card.
Who was she meeting there?
I don't know. Renee didn't either. Judging by the way she reacted when she first saw me, Jack thought. Like maybe she thought he was the contact, but then she knew it wasn't him. That meant she didn't know what he looked like, and it was probably a guy. Last thing she said to me before she died was a name. Samler. Maybe that's the guy she was meeting. Or the man who killed her.
First name?
She didn't say.
Brosa read Moore's business card.
Crowdscope? What is that?
A Silicon Valley fintech startup.
Excuse me?
Fintech?
Companies that apply new technologies to financial transactions, like using data analytics to acquire new customers, or robo-investing, that kind of thing. Renee was a financial wizard.
May I keep this?
Of course.
Do you happen to have your passport with you?
Yes. Jack pulled it out of a front zippered pocket of his cargo pants, stowed away against pickpockets, which were rife in the city. Brosa examined it, flipping pages for visa stamps. She snapped a picture of the page with Jack's information and passport number before handing it back to him.
And you, Jack, what do you do?
I'm in finance too, but not fintech. He pulled out his wallet, fished out a business card, and handed it to her. I'm a financial analyst with Hendley Associates out of Alexandria, Virginia.
Interesting work, I imagine.
Numbers always tell a story, if you know how to read them. Something Paul Brown taught me years ago. Brosa's cell phone rang.
Excuse me, Jack.
She turned away and spoke into her phone. A short exchange. Jack watched her in his peripheral vision. She ended the call and sighed.
Jack, I'm sorry. I have to go.
Is it possible you are staying in Barcelona for the next few days? I have more questions for you, and you are one of the few surviving eyewitnesses. Jack didn't know if he could extend his stay at his Airbnb or if Jerry would give him the extra time off, but there was no way in hell he was going back home until he found out who killed Moore, and until he was certain her killer would be brought to justice. Helping this CNI agent would be the easiest way to ensure both.
Of course.
But I need you to do me a favor.
If I can.
I need you to look into this Samler guy for me. I think that name is going to be important for solving this case.
Brosa gave him another searching look. Finally, her first small smile. I'll be in touch.
Chapter 6.
It was a 20-minute walk from the placeta where he'd been treated for his injuries back to his Airbnb apartment in Barceloneta, the old workers' neighborhood down by the beach that had recently revitalized. The explosion at the restaurant had put authorities on edge. Blue lights from police cars and motorcycles flashed at every intersection, and helicopters hovered protectively around the Ciutat Bella. Despite predictions to the contrary, no massive rallies for Catalonian independence spontaneously materialized. Jack didn't know if the peaceful protesters were afraid of suffering violence, or being blamed for more of it if another bombing attack occurred tonight. In this part of town, tourists seemed completely unaware of what had occurred just a kilometer away, only an hour before, as they flocked past the restaurants, hotels, and gelaterias on Passage de Joan de Borbó approaching the sea. Despite his attempts to clean up back at the church, some of the more observant did notice his blood-stained clothing. His head still pounding, Jack ducked into a tiny Carrefour Express for some aspirin and bottled water. He popped a couple and washed them down with a long gulp as he crossed back into the alley toward his place, willing himself up the 57 narrow, winding marble stairs to his door on the third floor. Still feeling like he'd been dragged behind a car on a rocky dirt road, he stripped off his clothes and hit the small but generous shower, letting the steam and hot water work their magic. He couldn't stop thinking about Moore and the light fading from her dimming eyes. Such a waste. A brilliant and beautiful woman who happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. He toweled off, trying to solve a couple of mysteries about her. A fintech kinda made sense. Finance was her thing. But a Silicon Valley startup? He remembered distinctly her dream of running, if not outright owning, a white shoe Wall Street investment firm. Both of her parents were corporate executives and had groomed her for the same life. She never struck him as the entrepreneurial type. On the risk-reward continuum, she was heavily slanted toward the latter. Maybe something went sideways in her career. Had to start over? And what would a Silicon Valley tech executive be doing in Barcelona? Possibly on vacation, like him, but not likely. She didn't have the wide-eyed look of a tourist. She was all business in her demeanor, and clearly on a mission to find whoever it was she was supposed to meet. Someone she had obviously never met before, which is a strange way to do business. His headache finally ebbing from the aspirin and shower, Jack reached into the fridge and grabbed a can of Mau Radler, a Clara, a Spanish beer mixed with lemon soda, which he'd come to crave these last few days. He plopped down at the little kitchen dinette that served as his office space and opened up his laptop, encrypted for security by Hendley Associates IT director Gavin Beery. It was just 5 o'clock in the afternoon local. He pulled up the contact information for the U.S. consulate in Barcelona in order to call them and tell them about René, in case the Spanish authorities hadn't yet done so. He discovered that the consulate had closed to the public at 1 p.m. He could call a 24-hour hotline, but he wanted to do it in person. He decided to pay them a visit first thing in the morning. He then Googled Moore's company, Crowdscope, and found the corporate website. It was about what he expected. Optimizing capital investments and business solutions through big data analytics, blah, blah, blah. Standard corporate speak, stock photos and bullet points. Nothing interactive. He clicked on the Who We Are tab and found Moore's contact information. She was listed as Vice President of Marketing, just as she was on her business card. Marketing. Her phone number and a Crowdscope email address were also given. It was a lot of information, but didn't really say much. But that was pretty common these days. Style over substance. Corporate clickbait. It was 11 a.m. EST, and Jack saw that Gavin was online back in Alexandria. He dialed Gavin's direct number on his smartphone. "Jack, I was just getting ready to shoot you a text. I read about the explosion in Barcelona. You weren't anywhere near it, were you? The photos online looked pretty bad." "Yeah. That's why I'm calling. You okay?" "I'm fine. But a friend of mine was there and got killed." "Oh, geez. I'm so sorry." "I'm sure you've got better things to do, but I wanted to ask you a favor."
"Name it."
"I'd like you to do a little digging into my friend for me. I'll send over the contact information and some links. I'd like to know more about the company she was working for, and more important, see if you can find a connection between her and a guy named Samler. Last name, I'm sure, no first. Phone records, OSINT, whatever you can find out about this guy and what he had to do with Renee.
What kind of connection should I be looking for? You think this Samler guy is tied to the bombing somehow?
Not sure. But his name was the last thing she said before she died, so I figure he must be important to her, and maybe he might have an idea about what happened.
Sounds like you were nearly killed yourself. Not really, Jack lied.
I'll jump right on this.
Things are pretty quiet around here right now. The whole team is still out on vacation, just like you. Even Jerry, so I've got time to kill.
Thanks, Gav. I really appreciate it.
Question for you. Did you see any CCTV cameras in the restaurant? What was its name?
Jack chided himself. Why didn't he think of that?
Maybe the explosion rattled his skull harder than he realized.
The name is Lovey. He spelled it out. And yes, I did see cameras, three of them. It would be awesome if you could get your hands on those tapes. Might tell us everything we need to know.
Won't be easy. Any chance you can hack the restaurant's computer and grab them?
Not if the computer has been blown to smithereens. And most likely, the videos are on digital cards or even actual digital tape if the system is old enough. I'm guessing the local police have already recovered whatever survived the blast.
I'm betting the cops don't have it. My guess is the CNI might. Those are the people who interviewed me after the blast. I'll be seeing my contact again tomorrow, I'm sure. I'll see what I can do on my end. I'll call you if I find anything. Just watch yourself, okay?
You know it.
Jack drained his clara as he put an email together for Gavin with links to Crowdscope and everything else he could think of and sent it off. He sent another email to Jerry, informing him he was extending his stay in Spain for a few more days, but Jerry's auto-reply bounced back, informing Jack that Jerry wouldn't be back in the office for another week. He took that as permission to hang around. He'd ask for forgiveness later, if needed. Jack then remembered about extending his stay at his place. Packing up and moving would be a pain in the butt. He shot a quick message through the Airbnb site, and his landlord responded minutes later, telling Jack he was thrilled to extend his stay for another week. Jack paid for the extension online in advance, then remembered to put his return airline ticket on hold. He also thought about his mom, who was not only a world-class eye surgeon and ophthalmologist, but also a heck of a psychic, as all good mothers were. She always seemed to know when he or one of his siblings was dancing on the edge of something that could hurt them. He dropped her a text telling her that he was far from the explosion she'd probably heard about on the news, and that he was coming home soon. It was the kind of lie he could only pull off in a text, because she would have seen right through him if he was standing in her presence. Thank God for texting. Satisfied he'd gotten a jump on things, he grabbed another clara from the fridge and dropped back in front of his computer. He'd only really glanced at the Brigada Catalan article and its brief references to other recent events connected to them. Since he had some time to kill, he decided to dig deeper. If Brigada Catalan was responsible for Renee's death, he'd do everything he could to help Brosa track them down. What the CNI agent didn't realize was that if she wasn't able or willing to deliver the justice that Renee deserved, he'd find a way to do it himself. One bullet at a time. 2 hours later, Jack shut his computer, his eyes watering from the river of facts about Catalonian independence he'd just been wading through. Gavin hadn't called him back, and he was hungry, so he decided on a hole-in-the-wall stand-up pizza joint around the corner for carryout. He snagged up his apartment keys and headed out, still processing what he'd just read. The Catalonian independence movement was anything but monolithic, but it was pretty clear the source of the current troubles was Catalonia's 2017 independence referendum, which passed by an overwhelming 90% of the vote, despite Madrid's attempts to disrupt it. Madrid declared the whole thing illegal and jailed the offending members of the Generalitat, the local legislature, and the rest of the Catalonian independence politicians fled, including the president, seeking asylum abroad. The officials in the European Union sided with Madrid against the Catalonian independence politicians, Brussels still had Brexit on its mind, not to mention the French Yellow Vests, the Italian Lega, Ireland's Sinn Féin, and others who wholly supported Madrid's actions. This only fueled Catalonian frustrations. The EU constitution promised self-determination and certainly voting rights, and both appeared to be violated in equal measure by both Madrid's heavy-handed actions and Brussels' failure to recognize Catalonia's claims.
According to what Jack read in the press, that's when Brigada Catalan was born.
Of course, history was the context for all of this. Catalonia had a distinct and separate national identity going back as far as the Roman era and the 5th century Visigoth kings who succeeded them. They lost their independence and were absorbed into the Spanish Empire by the Bourbon king Philip V, who conquered them in the beginning of the 18th century. In the 1930s, under the Spanish Republic, Catalonia was granted increasing autonomy, but the Spanish Civil War ended that dream. Catalonia had been the heart of the resistance to Franco's final overthrow of the Republican government in 1939. In revenge, the fascist Franco regime suppressed their language and culture for decades. Complicating everything else, Catalonia had always been the industrial heart of modern Spain and its most prosperous region. Consequently, Madrid had always taken a disproportionate share of its tax base from the region, another source of local resentment. Since Franco's death, Catalonian rights had been largely restored, and Català was now the primary language taught in its schools. Despite these reforms, Catalonian nationalists pressed for complete independence from Spain and the creation of an independent Catalonian state. Other regions in Spain, particularly the Basque, had expressed similar desires decades before and resorted to a bombing campaign that was ultimately subdued by Madrid. Spanish nationalist parties in Madrid wanted both order and central government, and saw Catalonian nationalism as a threat to the Spanish state. If Catalonia seceded, other regions in Spain might follow. Europe and the rest of the world were struggling with the centralism-nationalism debate. The benefits of national and regional integration were obvious, especially for the political elites and transnational corporations, but always at the cost of local identity and autonomy. The subtext to all of this, Jack noted, was the tendency of politicians on both sides of the Catalonian argument to exploit the passions of their people in exchange for their own political power. Separatist politicians weren't willing to accept Madrid's previous offers of even broader rights of Catalonian autonomy, even as Spanish nationalists stoked the fears of their followers in Madrid and elsewhere. Politicians' tendency to serve themselves at the expense of their communities wasn't unique to Spain. The United States suffered too many such fools, playing to identity politics at the expense of the national interest. Jack knew his father was the rarest breed of politician, the reluctant servant. In truth, most people just wanted to live their lives in peace and prosperity. This was particularly true in Barcelona, where life was very good for locals and visitors alike. Brigada Catalan rose up out of this confusion and frustration. They proclaimed that if democratic elections were no longer respected by Madrid and the will of the majority of Catalonians ignored, then violence was the only viable alternative to Madrid's totalitarian, Francoist, and fascist rule. Their online manifesto claimed solidarity with other independence movements throughout history, including the American Revolution, but leaned heavily on Latin American revolutionary sloganeering. In part, Jack believed, because so many Latin American immigrants lived and worked in Barcelona and throughout Spain. Jack entered the small but pristine Kitchen Barcelona on Carrera de la Maquinista and queued up behind a couple of locals. The air smelled of fresh-baked crusts, gooey cheeses, and ripe, spicy olives. He felt like he was cheating by eating Italian food, but it was owned and operated by local Catalanes, which technically made it Spanish food. Besides, it was freaking good. The place was barely shoulder-wide between the glass case and the stand-up bar on the wall. The handsome, flour-dusted pizza chef stood just beyond another doorway, shoveling pies one at a time into the only oven in a kitchen not much bigger than a broom closet. Jack had been here once before, It was fresh, fantastic food, and the cute girl behind the counter had both an awesome sleeve tattoo and an excellent English vocabulary. Jack didn't worry about Brigada Catalan attacking this place. It was too small and too out of the way. But the killers who murdered René were out there in the city somewhere, and he knew they would strike again until Catalonia won its independence, or until they died fighting for it. If Jack had anything to say about it, it would be the latter. Chapter 7. Mountain View, California. They were both lean and narrow-shouldered, with medium brown hair, brown eyes, and fair complexions, which was why people who first met them assumed they were siblings. But Chris and Carrie Fast were married, first meeting, then dating, and eventually falling in love, all at the Google AI Quantum Labs in Mountain View. They even recited their wedding vows standing beneath Stan, the iconic full-size T-Rex skeleton on the Googleplex campus, surrounded by friends, family, and pink flamingos. The childless 42-year-olds loved not owning a car. It wasn't that the two senior Google scientists couldn't afford any luxury vehicle they wanted, or the insane insurance rates, or even a full-time driver to avoid the hassles of Bay Area driving. Riding bikes, ride-sharing, and not owning a car was really about keeping a low-carbon footprint, and equally important, demonstrating their public commitment to combating climate change. For trips to the city, they always used Uber, including tonight's benefit gala for their favorite local no-kill animal shelter. Uber's convenient phone app was on the front page of both their iPhones. Only Nooglers, new Google employees, thought that Android phones were required at the Plex. Despite the fact that they didn't own a luxury vehicle, they certainly enjoyed the experience of riding in one, which was why they always opted for Uber Lux. Tonight was no different. And in truth, they needed the extra space, since they were bringing their companion dogs, a miniature Maltese named Cookie and a Papillon, often mistaken for a long-haired Chihuahua named Louis, with a silent S in the French manner, after the Dustin Hoffman character in the movie of the same name. All four stood expectantly on the wide, tree-lined suburban street outside their one-story mid-century rancher as the roomy Cadillac Escalade glided to a halt at the curb. Carrie double-checked her Uber app, confirming the make, model, and license plate of the vehicle. The smiling, well-built young Nigerian who opened their doors was the driver listed on the app as well. Good to go, she thought, as the four of them climbed into the back seat. They were greeted with bottled Fiji waters and organic treats for the dogs. There were bright smiles and wagging tails all around as the big SUV pulled away from the curb. They had no idea it was going to be the night of their lives. October 25th. Chapter 8. Walter Reed National Military Medical Center, Bethesda, Maryland. Where do we find such men? He asked himself. President Ryan stood over the bed of Lieutenant Corporal Brad Schaefer, 3rd Battalion Marine Raider Regiment. Men? Kid doesn't look old enough to shave. It never ceased to amaze him. The fate of the Republic had always been held in the strong, skilled hands of young warfighters like Schaefer. They all seemed to be young these days. Or maybe he was just getting to be that old. You shouldn't have gone to all the trouble, sir, Schaefer said. It's my honor, son. You did a hell of a good thing out there. Ryan nodded at the Navy Cross he'd just pinned to the boy's hospital gown. Your folks will get word about that today. The Chief of Naval Operations, CNO, Admiral Talbot, stood next to POTUS. Unfortunately, the citation won't include any details of your mission, nor will it be released to the press because the mission is still classified. Understood, sir. Ryan added, but I hope you know how grateful the nation is for your sacrifice. My boys would have done the same for me, sir. President Ryan had read Schaefer's service jacket. For conspicuous gallantry and unyielding courage in the face of overwhelming enemy forces in defense of his team, the Secretary of the Navy had written in Schaefer's citation. It had cost the boy dearly. The after-action report read like a Don Bentley novel. It was an operation in Niger, Two of Schaefer's team were wounded, and one killed in an ambush by Boko Haram forces, tipped off by a local police captain on their payroll. Schaefer had single-handedly saved his brothers-in-arms by advancing into enemy fire, taking out a KPV 14.5 heavy machine gun and an RPG, then laying down covering fire until the Blackhawks arrived. As far as Ryan was concerned, the boy deserved the Congressional Medal of Honor, but that wasn't his call. And in his experience, men like Schaefer didn't do what they did for medals. They did it because that was the job they were trained to do, and they were determined to do it no matter the cost. It frustrated Ryan that 1 in 5 meritorious citations were privately awarded these days. Valor should be celebrated, not hidden. But he understood the rationale. There were so many classified missions around the globe that even some members of the congressional oversight committees were surprised to find out where and when they occurred, let alone how frequently. Such was the price of eternal vigilance. The enemy never slept and never stopped moving until young warfighters like Schaefer dropped them in the dirt. Ryan worried that there were too many bad guys out there, and not enough Schaefers willing to hunt them down. "I understand you threw ball in high school," Ryan said, trying to change the subject. "You follow the Nats this year?" Schaefer smiled beneath his facial bandages. "Nah, sir. I'm a Georgia boy. Braves all the way." He held up the amputated stump of his right arm. "Doc says they're going to wire me up with some new bionic Luke arm. Guess they're going to make me a cyborg. After I muster out, I'm going to try out for Atlanta, because I'll be throwing 200-mile-per-hour pitches with that bad boy. The Braves would be lucky to have you, but trust me, the Nats are the way to go," Ryan joked. Schaefer grinned. He was missing a few teeth.